I next met with Dr. Elias Jabbour, and to begin, he presented a 51-year-old man from his practice.
And he had a CBC done, and the CBC done showing a high white count, like a 30,000 was left shift. That triggers a bone marrow done, possible leukemia. Obviously, he's from Houston, so he came to Anderson, like scared, what's going on? So we did a workup on him. At that time, he did not have big spleen, had only high white count, left shift. So essentially had minimal disease, CML chronic phase. I offered him therapy. We had frontline therapy with second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. At the time, the drug were not yet approved versus imatinib therapy. Being young and healthy from Houston, we went for second gen TKI and we gave them dasatinib.
As you thought through the initial recommendation, could you talk about some of the things that you thought about with him and some of the things in general that you think about when you try to decide, you know, what TKI to start with?
Okay. Well, you know, at that time in 2009, we did not know what we know about side effects. So today I'm more concerned about the serious adverse events I encountered. So in my practice today, how do I choose my TKI? In the frontline therapy, you have three options available. You have imatinib, nilotinib, and dasatinib. Today, in the state of where we are in the U.S., somebody with low-risk disease, like low so-called score, means essentially that doesn't have big spleen or high basal fit percentage or other feature of aggressive disease, I may go for imatinib therapy. Now, if somebody with high-risk features and young, I will go for second-gen tyrosine kinase inhibitors like dasatinib or nilotinib. My choice will be based as well on comorbidities. Essentially, somebody with lung injury, smokers, I know that these are risk factors for pleural effusion. I will avoid dasatinib, go for nilotinib. In contrast, somebody with diabetes, atherosclerosis, vascular issues, I will go for dasatinib versus nilotinib therapy. So comorbidities does dictate my choice. Now, moving forward to 2016, everybody is concerned about generic and the price of the drugs. And that will be a major factor dictating what to choose among the TKIs. Today, prices are more or less the same, or second-gen TKI are more expensive, a little bit more expensive. You're not very concerned about pricing. But moving forward, I think insurance plan and pricing will dictate your choice of therapy.
But even right now, today, can you describe a patient, before we're even getting to the issue of generic imatinib, where you actually would prefer imatinib right now?
Somebody coming to see me today at Anderson outside clinical trials, I will go for imatinib unless there's a reason not to. For example, high-risk disease, I would go for second-gen TKI, but the average comer with CML in the U.S., 75% are low-risk disease. These will do so well with imatinib therapy.
And are you choosing imatinib because you think it's a better drug or a better choice or because it's slightly less expensive?
Well, again, moving forward, price will dictate my choice today. It's not dictating my choice yet. I'm using imatinib because in a low-risk disease, the advantage of second-gen TKI is marginal and there's no impact on survival. I mean, I can start on imatinib therapy, assess at 2 to 6 months. If there's a good response, I will keep imatinib. If not, I will switch. And so far, we have not seen an advantage on overall survival.
So this man got started on dasatinib. Can you talk about what happened?
So he started on dasatinib, and like every patient on second-gen TKI, mainly dasatinib, had faster and deeper response. Mean had a CCYR within 6 months, which was great. Patient was taking his medicine. He went back to Saudi Arabia, and he came back for the follow-up. At that time, he was found to have 20,000 white count. It was shocking for us because he was responding so well. We did a bone marrow on him. He had no transformation, and we found a mutation called F317L mutation. It's very rare, but it does happen. 5 to 10% may not do so well on second-gen TKI, and F317L mutation is a mutation that drives resistance. So this patient was switched to ponatinib because he failed two major TKIs, had a mutation, and he had underlying complex mechanism of resistance. So we thought ponatinib is the best drug for him, yet he doesn't have C59 mutation. I gave him ponatinib 30 milligrams per day for a reason, because from the phase 1 trials and the phase 2, the drug was shown to be effective at a lower dose. I was concerned about vascular events, and we know in a retrospective way that vascular events on ponatinib are observed at a higher frequency at 45 milligrams per day. So in order to avoid that, we give them 30 milligrams per day. He responded, had a full match donor. So the question was, shall I maintain him on ponatinib or go for transplantation? It's not a white and black answer, and it was tough. But because he failed two TKIs, because he acquired clonal evolution, another form of aggressivity of the clone, and because he's young and he have a donor, full sibling, we went for transplantation. And after transplant, I maintained him on ponatinib 15 milligrams per day, and with that, he's doing so well.
So you're planning to continue the ponatinib indefinitely?
I don't know. As long as there's no problem of tolerance, I would keep the drug.
What is the usual approach? I never really thought about this post-allo transplant in terms of TKIs.
You know, there's no data. There's no evidence in chronic phase. It's more in blast phase disease. We'd like to maintain them on TKI because we know whenever they have molecular relapse, that is a sign of a relapse. In the chronic phase, because they failed two TKIs, I was concerned about being at a high risk of relapse, and if he lost post-transplantation, I don't have many options to offer him. I decided for maintenance therapy. Now, as you said, I may not keep him on it for maybe more than a year or 2 or 3 years, but at least for the now being, he has no side effect, he had no vascular issues, and at 50 milligrams, it's a small dose.
Anything new with ponatinib? Anything that we've learned more about the drug? And also, I've never been exactly clear qualitatively in terms of the cardiovascular problems. Are they qualitatively different than what you see with other TKIs or just more frequent?
No, definitely they are more frequent than what we observe with other TKIs. For example, I think ponatinib, the drug with the highest level of vascular events, followed by nilotinib, followed by dasatinib, bosutinib, and imatinib therapy. So it's the highest. Now, the side effect observed were around 13% per year of therapy, and that has been stable. There was no increase with time of therapy. Now, what we know so far, that based on a PACE trial, that patients with risk factors at the beginning, like somebody who had cardiac bypass surgery, is at higher risk of having vascular event on a drug. Somebody with a 45 milligram per day had a higher risk of having an event. Somebody who's 80 years old have a higher risk of events because age is another factor. Somebody with diabetes had a high risk of vascular events. So in our practice today, we definitely try to optimize risk factors before starting somebody on ponatinib, one. Second, because the drug is very potent and because you can minimize the side effect by using the dose, in our practice, we use 30 milligrams per day and then we reduce to 15. Means in CML, you can move into induction strategy followed by maintenance. You don't have to give the full dose the whole time of therapy, and that move you to a new era of induction consolidation. In order to learn more about side effects and how we can avoid them, a new trial is about to start in the US and worldwide, assessing ponatinib at a lower dose, 45 versus 30 milligram versus 15. And the idea is to induce a response and reduce the dose down to 15 once a CCYR, for example, is achieved, and see whether using this strategy we can reduce the risk of vascular events.
Can you talk a little bit more about the types of vascular events that have been observed?
Okay. Well, we did see the venous and the arterial. The venous, they don't concern me. That's fine. You can handle them. The arterial can be small arteries, like we do see with nilotinib, or we can do see major arteries. We did see stroke. We did see MI. We did see mesenteric infarct. We did see renal syndrome as well. We did see, unfortunately, among young patients having these vascular problems. Whenever you have it, I think today we have to stop the drug. There's no way you keep going on a drug unless you have no other options, no transplant, 359 mutation. You may want to reduce the dose and optimize everything you can. In a PACE trial, there was 10 deaths from vascular events. 5 of them were related and 5 of them not completely related or not directly related, but somehow they have some connection.
And another drug that's been approved in CML, and I'm not quite clear how often it's used, is omecetaxine. What is it, and are there situations where you use the drug?
Okay. Omecetaxine, it's not a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's a drug that inhibits the protein synthesis. The drug is an old drug, was assessed in the 90s, and then imatinib was available. The drug did drop behind because it's given sub-Q. And then there was some modification of the drug, so to get a new patent called omecetaxine. The drug has shown activity in patients with 359 mutation and in patients who failed multiple TKIs. In a pivotal trial that led to the approval in the chronic phase, the rate of CCYR was 10%. compared to 50% on ponatinib. So it's really a big difference. Now, the drug is given sub-Q twice daily for 14 days. It was approved in 2012. Limitation is how you give the drug. As of last year, the label was changed. You can give the drug right now at home, not in an office or hospital-based setting, which is more practical for the patient. Still, it's a sub-Q injection for 14 days. The problem with the drug, it can cause myelosuppression. And therefore, 14 days, it's a lot of drug to be given. So we need to address this question, maybe considering lower dose. In my practice, I do not use 2 weeks. I use 1 week at the beginning and then 3 days later on in order to minimize myelosuppression and see how it goes. Where it does place, I don't think, I mean, somebody will use the drug before exhausting all other TKIs. Eventually, somebody who had poor tolerance to oral drug, that may play a role. Or if they're blastic phase disease where you have, like, you give combination of omastaxin and TKI. To be honest with you, in CML, it's really the last drug to be given, but you may want to think more about off-label use, like combination with TKIs, or maybe inpatient in whom you want to stop therapy, where you can give TKI plus omastaxin in order to convert them into CMR, no disease, and stop the drug. It's off-label. But that is one way to assess the drug. And I give you a real example. I had a patient who's young, who's 36 years old, who wants to become pregnant. And she had disease, minimal disease positive. I did discuss with her to give her the omastaxin and TKI. And obviously, I will give lower dose 3 days because she doesn't have disease. She's thinking about it, and we haven't started yet, but that is a plan I have for her. Other area where the drug is being explored or maybe worth to investigate is beyond blast phase disease. It's in AML or MDS, post-failure of decitabine or AZA, or in combination with AZA or decitabine and AML, unfit for chemotherapy. But that is investigation at the time being.
In this strategy of combining a TKI with omacitaxin, I've heard, I think it was actually your colleague, Dr. Kantarjian, talk about with a thought of maybe trying to go for a cure. Anything new in terms of that? Any data? Any other strategies that are being looked at right now to try to cure the disease?
Well, the largest series is essentially from Europe. François-Xavier Mahon, there was a study called EuroSki, 400 patients attached, meeting. Still, the relapse rate is around, with single agent TKI, they go into what we call deep molecular response for at least 1 year, and they stop the drug. Around 50 to 60% do relapse. Now, some of them do respond very well. Accidentally, we do see blast transformation, and that is, for me, very concerning. I mean, in the U.S., I don't feel comfortable stopping TKI and have a blast phase. Even 1 per 100 or 1 per 1,000 come back in a blast phase. That is really scary. So at my institution, we don't favor stopping TKI outside a major clinical trials. Now, one other idea is maybe combining TKI with something else that can affect the stem cell or checkpoint inhibitors that can really eradicate the disease. That is still being investigated. The problem with this trial in the U.S. is how we accrue patients, because they are on TKI, they're doing so well. I want to get them a new compound. I mean, they come to Houston or any centers, we have to do like a monthly visit and side effect. They are not very excited. As a proof of principle, I think we should investigate it, but we're having a hard time get this idea moving into practice. I totally believe, like Dr. Kantarjian, that we can cure CML by this combination more so than just stopping TKI single agent.
So let's switch over and talk a little bit about myelofibrosis and P. vera. Maybe we can begin with your 48-year-old man.
Well, I had a patient who came to see me because he's taking hydroxyurea, had PV for 8 years. He's a young man. He is 48 years old, which is not typical, by the way, of PV. But what I want to highlight is age is crucial. Young patients, they live longer, and age per se is a competing factor for bad outcome. Like if you're 80 years old and you want to live 5 years, you may not have the long-term complication like somebody who's 48 years old. The guy who's 48 years old, his father passed away from cardiac arrest at a young age. His brother with some intolerance to glucose. So there are vascular problems known for a fact. So this guy, he's a smoker. He's a young man and risk factors. He's being phlebotomized. Not very often at the beginning, but when he moved to Houston, he came from New York, he started having like phlebotomies once a year, twice a year. Now he's getting like every other month. And then he's on hydroxyurea. For whatever reason, he tells me hydroxyurea causes him insomnia, he's making him dysfunctional, daytime he doesn't do so well, and he cannot take it anymore. So whether it's hydroxyurea related or the disease per se not being controlled, that is an unknown. The drug ruxotinib was approved for PV patients who are intolerant or resistant to hydroxyurea. So here it's a mixed syndrome of disease being progressive, requiring more phlebotomies, having symptoms, inflammation. On physical exam, he had spleen of 4 or 5 centimeters, not too big, but kind of splenomegaly. Knowing that PV, you don't have early on big spleen. So the question for me were, okay, I switch him to ruxotinib, 10 milligram BID, or another form of interferon therapy, PEG interferon. Why I thought of both of them, that was in December, just before the approval of ruxotinib. So I did not have a trial. And I told them, I will see you in January, and we go from there. No, in January, the drug was approved, so I gave him ruxotinib. But I discussed with them the two options, PEG interferon or ruxotinib. Why I discussed this with them? Because PEG interferon can be given sub-Q, not pills every day. Second, in a trials published by MD Anderson, by us, and by the French, we showed that PEG interferon can induce what we call complete molecular remission, meaning the clone, the allele burden with the JAK2 V617F mutation was gone. We tried to get the drug. Insurance did not approve it. And then it was a holiday. He came back after the holidays. I started him on ruxolitinib, 10 milligram BID. Right away, his spleen after a month is completely shrinking, which is not surprising, and he's feeling much better. Now, it's still too early to assess the phlebotomy's need. He was on every other month. I started him, I think, beginning of January. He had only one episode of phlebotomy, but I think he's into the good trend for a good response later on. So that is a success story so far. You need to keep his hemoglobin below 15, intensive control of the hemoglobin in order to prevent a further thrombotic event that has been shown.
What's your personal experience been using ruxolitinib for PV?
I did use it in clinical trials and in commercial a few patients. Side effect, very well tolerable drug. The problem is you have to take it every single day and you have to watch the count very carefully early on. So you have to tune the dose a little bit, but so far it hasn't been a problem. So they take 10 milligram BID and they are very happy. Quality of life has changed dramatically. So keep in mind, in PV, I'm not aiming survival endpoints here. I'm improving the hemoglobin number and the control of the symptoms, essentially controlling the symptoms.
Do you see the same rapidity of clinical response in PV as you do with MF?
It's actually very rapid in PV, and I'll tell you why, because you don't have to deal with myelosuppression as much as you do with MF. The problem with MF, you improve the symptoms, but you don't improve the spleen so fast because you need to hold the drug. You know, MF patients, they don't come to see you because their count is 300,000. They come to see you because your platelets are 75 or 100. And when you give 20, 25 milligram BID of ruxolitinib, I have myelosuppression problem. I have to handle it. So I have to reduce the dose and take it easy at the beginning and try to keep them on a drug with the hope you can maintain the drug and have the desired effect you want. In PV, you don't have to deal with myelosuppression as much as you do with MF patients.
What about the duration of response with PV and MF to ruxolitinib?
Okay. Now, with PV, so far, the response trial, the outcome is you have 1 year follow-up, 90% are maintaining the response. With MF, we have a longer follow-up. On average, if you consider spleen size, go back to baseline, it's around 2.5 to 3 years. Now, keep in mind that even if the spleen does shrink or fluctuate, the symptoms can be controlled longer. So therefore, we keep patients on therapy. And one of the reasons we keep them as well, because we don't have an alternative. Like, okay, I have somebody in a community, I give them ruxolitinib, and then what do I do if you're not responding so well? I will ask him, do you have any benefit? He said, yes, I'm still be able to play golf or walk or something. Then stay on a drug, knowing that he may be losing his response or progressing, but I don't have an alternative for the patient.
What about other agents, other JAK inhibitors in the MF and, for that matter, PV? And one I've heard about is pacritinib. What do we know about that?
So pacritinib is a good drug. It's a JAK2 inhibitor. The advantage of pacritinib compared to ruxolitinib, it doesn't cause much myelosuppression. The drug is being assessed in somebody with a low count and being compared to a best available therapy, including ruxolitinib for somebody with a low count. We'll see. It's very promising. Somebody with a low count, we know that this candidate, they don't do so well with ruxolitinib because of the myelosuppression. That may overcome the problem. The problem of the drug, it can cause GI side effect, and therefore we have to think the pros and cons when you consider the drug. Another drug called momelotinib is being investigated, but I think it's falling behind the other two drugs.
When you talk about myelosuppression, are you talking about both anemia as well as thrombocytopenia?
Both, exactly. I'm talking about thrombocytopenia and anemia, and we know these are dependent on a baseline count.
And again, with pacineb, you see both less thrombocytopenia, less anemia?
Correct. Correct. And the efficacy is similar in the two categories.
You mentioned GI problems. What kinds of GI problems?
Diarrhea and nausea, vomiting.
Have you used the drug yourself?
In a setting of clinical trials, yes.
What did you see?
You know, it's manageable. It's highly manageable. So if you ask me to trading between myelosuppression and GI, I will tell you GI, I can manage it. I may reduce the dose. So obviously somebody with a low count, pacritinib will be my best choice. Let's say today in our practice, we have the two drugs available. Somebody with 100,000 platelets or below, or 110, I will go pacritinib. But that is not available to us today.
What about somebody with anemia?
Similar. I will think anemia and thrombocytopenia are, I put them at the same level, although you can give blood, thrombocytopenia, it's hard to treat, but still.
How do you approach dosing of ruxolitinib in patients with anemia and thrombocytopenia?
You know, the whole idea is try not to stop the therapy. So I will start the lower dose and go up. And I give you an example. Somebody with 200,000 platelets, I'm fine. I have no issues with them. But somebody with 100,000 platelets, 110, not somebody low platelets, I will use 10 milligram and then go up with the dose. I will do blood tests on a weekly basis and try to escalate every 4 weeks to reach 20 milligram BID or even higher if you want to. Because I prefer to start a lower dose and have control of the symptoms and not to stop the drug. The whole problem is if you give the drug and then you have to stop it. So if you stop it, you will lose your benefit within 7 days. So what's happening in the community, you get the drug and you have to stop it for 1 week or two because you have somebody with a low count. No, I will use the drug at a lower dose and I will escalate. But you need at least 10 milligram BID or even higher to get some spleen effect. One. Second, you can give the drug and you can add something to treat the red blood cells. For example, I'd use danazole in my practice. You have to be careful for somebody with thrombotic events, but try to help the hemoglobin in order to provide the right dose and escalate. The key question is titrate based on a hemoglobin and the platelets. Go slow and progressive, increase your count, and try to avoid stopping the drug.
When you do stop the drug, do you see kind of a reversal, essentially, what you see in the beginning? In other words, you hear stories about people within a week or two, you know, dramatically feeling better. If you stop it within a week or two, are they dramatically feeling worse?
Correct. Usually, if you stop the drug within 7 days, you get people to start complaining of the baseline symptoms.
Anything new with the biology and the pathophysiology of MF in terms of mutations?
You know, we're doing sequence of mutations. We know, for example, that first of all, we have JAK2 mutation discovered, and then that we're followed by the CAR reticulin mutation and the MPL mutation. And there's today's scoring system that can tell you how your patient will do. For example, if you have CAR reticulin mutation, you do the best. You have the most indolent course. And not only you need to check for mutation for prognosis, but for diagnostic purpose as well. Because sometimes you can have somebody with fibrotic bone marrow. You don't know if it's truly a myelofibrosis, but if you have the clone with JAK2 mutation or the CAR reticulin mutation, you're more comfortable. It's more MF than anything else. So you need for diagnostic and prognostic. Somebody who had the triple negative mutation, for example, they don't have CAR reticulin, they don't have JAK2, they don't have MPL, they have the worst outcome. Somebody who's 50 years old coming to my clinic with triple negative mutations, I will think of transplantation down the road. So the mutations, not only per se, they play a role, but even if you do a staging using what we call the DIPSS, among the DIPSS, somebody with low-risk disease scoring by DIPSS, if I will add the mutation into that, I can select a group in whom maybe transplant should be offered right away and do not go for a wait and watch strategy.
What's the correlation between response, say, to ruxolitinib and various types of mutations? I know initially, you know, just looking at JAK mutations, it didn't seem like there's any relationship. Now that we know about these other mutations, what do we know?
Still, we don't know much. There's no clear correlation between response and the mutations. It has more impact on transformation and survival rather than just having four response, one. Second, you may acquire other clones where you start somebody on therapy or you're watching. Let's say somebody had JAK2 mutation and you monitor them very carefully and you acquire another mutation, that is really bad. But so far, not for therapy.
What about new agents in MF?
You know, there's a lot of agents being assessed. Among them, for example, the histone deacetylase inhibitor. At ASH, there was several presentation. One, we have anti-fibrotic agents being assessed. So far, we have not seen much happening. We do see, for example, with the histone deacetylase inhibitors, more side effect encountered. My concern with this, the combination is more sequential than concomitant because of side effect issues that may not outweigh the benefit observed. So keep your eyes open on this topic. The one thing is showing good results eventually when you have the mixed syndrome of MDS and PN. You can combine ruxolitinib plus decitabine or AZA. So you have a patient with mixed clone of MDS and MF, of MPN and MDS. So you may want to consider a combination of azacitidine and ruxolitinib, maybe not concomitantly but sequentially, in order to target the two clones and improve the outcome, that being assessed as well.
Anything new in terms of the question of whether or not agents like JAK inhibitors are reversing the underlying disease or really just dealing with the phenotype, the symptomatology?
As you know, there were some anecdotal cases of fibrosis being reversible, but I cannot make a statement on that. It's still too early, at least not known solidly. So I don't think that is the case today. This is why we need a combination of agents that can revert the fibrosis and target more the clone than just having to improve the symptoms and the spleen size.
So let's talk a little bit about MDS and AML. And I was intrigued by your 95-year-old lady with MDS. That sounds like it was a challenge.
You know, she's a 95-year-old. She used to be a nurse at MD Anderson.
Wow.
Well fit. Her husband is a cardiologist. So she was diagnosed with MDS. She had 16% of blasts at the time. Karyotype was abnormal. So she came to Anderson and I gave her azacitidine.
What was her clinical condition?
She was well fit. She was playing tennis. Performance was 1 or 0 for somebody who's 95 years old. Amazing.
Wow. Playing tennis.
Playing tennis. Yes, I swear, playing tennis.
Wow.
So I gave her AZA, 75 milligrams per square, 5 days, not 7 days. And with that, after, I mean, she was stable at the beginning, but then she went to CR. But more interestingly than CR, because even in CR, they will tell you persistent MDS clone. If you read the pathology report, they will always tell you you have MDS. Now, the blasts did drop, which is fine. And the platelets did come up very significantly and very nicely. But that did take us 3 to 4 cycles to get there. But then the first bone marrow at 3 months, okay, she had trisomy 8 and she had derivative of chromosome 614. So these two abnormalities, she was intermediate too. Bone marrow done at 3 months, the karyotype was deployed in all metaphases. And yet at the time, she wasn't yet in CR. CR did follow later on. And here what we discovered, what we learned is that, you know, when you had the clone, the pathologist will read young cells as a blast and they may not be disease. The underlying clone is improving and that is good. That triggers us at MD Anderson to go back and assess outcome based on karyotype being abnormal and normalized, like CML or AML, where if you normalize the clone, you do so well. In fact, we showed that patient in whom the clone, abnormal clone, will become normal or disappear is a major factor for survival. In fact, we double survival for this patient, goes from 15 months to 30 months if they have normal karyotype. So this woman responded very well, achieved a CCYR for 2.5 years, and then she lost her response. When she lost her response, she transformed into AML. And she had 40% of blasts, and she started becoming sicker and sicker and sicker. She elected not to do any care, and she went to hospice, and unfortunately, she passed away. But there's a clear story that, you know, you can improve outcome of MDS patients. And these patients, where you achieve a CCYR, you have a good outcome. Now, I want to take you back to the pivotal trials for MDS patients. If you look at the curve, the tail of the curve, you will have a plateau where patients may survive. It's not a big percentage, but maybe 10 to 15% in whom you have a tail, and they remain alive. Therefore, saying the transplant is the only curative approach for MDS may not be too accurate. We still need to know who are these patients, who may do well in the long run, and may benefit from a long-term strategy with decitabine or azacitidine.
I'm sure you see a lot of patients with MDS who've been managed in the community and then come into you for another opinion. Any sort of practice patterns you see out there of people doing things that maybe aren't optimal?
You know, first of all, unfortunately, they still do one cycle or two and they say patients are not responding, go to Anderson, go see clinical trials. I think it's not a good practice. We know with the decitabine or AZA, you need 4 to 6 cycles to and use good response. So having one course or two and saying not responding, it's too early, too anticipated, need to be like staying longer. Or you see the opposite. I give AZA or decitabine and then at 1 month, I see the count still zero, and I decide to delay the chemotherapy because of myelosuppression. Well, you tell them, get a bone marrow done. They say, no, it's painful. I think when we have a low count, one should be very careful because the low count could be driven by persistent disease. And rather than stopping therapy and wait for the recovery, go back and resume the treatment. This is the only way you can control the disease and get the count recovered. That is not done appropriately. Third, we do see crossover. They give them azacitidine for 3 cycles and not responding, go for decitabine because decitabine is the only agent available. This is what they have. I think if you have somebody who's failing AZA or decitabine, you need to give, first of all, 6 courses. And then if you fail, consider clinical trials. The outcome is really poor for this patient, and we don't have any drug available for them.
How do you choose between AZA and decitabine?
You know, in our practice, when we compare in our data, I think they are equivalent. Decitabine and AZA are exactly equivalent. So I will pick whatever I'm comfortable with. Decitabine is given IV over 5 days, AZA sub-Q or IV for 7 days, although I do not use 7 days, I use 5 days in my practice. So whatever you're comfortable with, I think they are equivalent. Now, the trials, as you know, were reported and showed survival improvement for AZA, not for decitabine, but that has to do with the design of the trial. I don't think the decitabine trial was designed in an optimal way to show survival improvement. No, we have a trial ongoing where we're comparing AZA versus decitabine head-to-head. We'll see.
One other question going back to this patient. I'm curious, did she enter a hospice program?
So she was in Houston, MD Anderson. We consulted palliative care and our case manager. And then usually come visit the patient and they accept her. She went to hospice locally, like in a medical center.
How long was she in hospice before she died?
For a week.
A week. The reason I ask you is I've seen data, it's kind of interesting, and we actually have data ourselves from some surveys that suggest that people with hematologic cancers spend, in general, not specifically MDS, seem to spend less time in hospice. And I guess there's a lot of speculation, maybe it's harder to give up on these patients. I'm just kind of curious whether you have any thoughts about that.
Okay, well, you have two figures here. If you have somebody with proliferative disease, like high white count, they don't last. Usually they are very sick, they have proliferation, they are infected, they go to hospice and they don't last at all. In contrast, when you have somebody with a low count, usually they stay at home before they go to hospice. So it may confirm what you're saying, they don't stay a long time in hospice, but they have been in kind of hospice setting between home, getting some blood, they have a low count and they maintain themselves, and they only give up to hospice if there's no care for them or their family or social constraint. So I think there's a hidden life of the hospice. We're not reporting the true amount of time spent over there, but supportive care, essentially for low-risk MDS, they stay at home more so than going to a facility.
Let's talk a little bit about AML, and I'm curious about your take on the data presented at the ASH plenary session on sorafenib.
Well, definitely sorafenib does improve outcome of this patient. We know FLT3-ITD is a bad marker for AML, and even if you transplant them, they don't do so well. So in this study, present in plenary session at the ASH meeting, there was an improvement of survival without event. When we look in our database, when you compare historically, when you give sorafenib for patients with AML, FLT3-ITD mutated, you improve their outcome. So I think in 2015, although it's not yet approved for this drug, we should always check for FLT3-ITD. And if you have this mutation, you have to consider sorafenib in combination with chemotherapy. If you have somebody who's young patient, with you give them 3+7 or IA, you should give them IA plus sorafenib. If you're somebody who's unfit for chemotherapy, in whom you consider decitabine or AZA, you should consider it in combination with sorafenib or other new FLT3 inhibitors that may come to the market. They are not available yet.
I thought that the benefits that were seen of sorafenib in that study were independent of FLT mutation status.
It is true. Still, the debate is, shall we give it to everybody across the board? That is unknown. Keep in mind, there was no survival in the study reported, so it's questionable today. At least if you're going to give it for the FLT3-ITD mutated patient rather than across the board, because insurance will call you, tell you, the drug is not used, it's off-label. At least if you want to take a group, go with the mutated patients.
What about other FLT3 inhibitors, including crizartinib?
Quizartinib is one of the most potent FLT3 inhibitors. Unfortunately, it's not yet approved for AML. Another drug called crenolinib as well. It does affect not only the ITD, but the point mutations. It's still not yet available. These are promising compounds. You ask me about what else in AML. I think one of the best drugs available is ABT-199. It's anti-BCL2 inhibitor. It's extremely promising. The drug is being assessed in CLL and AML. It's anti-apoptotic drug. Trials are ongoing and seem to be very promising. At the ASH meeting, there was some data from MD Anderson presented by Dr. Konopleva, very promising drug in AML patients.
Yeah, it has a name now, venetoclax. One of the issues there has been tumor lysis syndrome. I know they've been kind of manipulating the dose and schedule. Is this also an issue with AML?
It is. I mean, so far we're doing it as per CLL. So whenever I have somebody on ABT-119 and escalate, I put them in, I watch them very carefully. We haven't seen it, but the company doesn't want to take a risk, and I understand completely. But the TLS is different than what you see with the Burkitt. Like, you give chemotherapy and you have TLS. I don't know the mechanism, but that is indeed a concern. But I think it's minor.
So have you had patients who've received single-agent treatment with this drug who clearly had clinical benefit?
I did. I have somebody in CLL.
How about AML?
In AML, I did give it in combination with decitabine. And to be honest with you, I just today reviewed my patient with my nurse, and the three patients with AML unfit for chemotherapy in whom I gave decitabine plus ABT-119, all three achieved the remission after one course, which is unheard, because when you give decitabine for these patients, you need several courses. And here we are after one course, we have a good response. The one thing you see with the drug, you see neutropenia. So they recover, the blast will go away, and then they recover their platelets, but they remain neutropenic for a while. So you have to hold decitabine, wait till they recover, and resume it later on.
So is this primarily the way the drug's being studied in AML?
Well, the drug was studied at the beginning as a single agent, but here we're giving in combination in AML unfit for chemotherapy.
Let's finish out talking about APL and your 25-year-old lady.
So I had a patient who came to see me months ago. I was on call. She's 25 years old. She came essentially with heavy menstruation. And then we did a workup on her right away. She came with a 30,000 weight count, platelets being 15. And she had aurodes on a smear. We did a bone marrow. We did a POT test. And we rushed for 15-17. She was found to be APL. So APL, whenever you have somebody in whom you're suspecting APL, give ATRA immediately. This woman, she came to see us because of the APL, but she was high-risk disease based on low platelets and high white count. So count above 10,000, platelet below 30,000, define somebody high-risk. Now, what we give for these patients? So we use ATRA-arsenic trioxide as our frontline regimen for these patients. Now, I remind you, a couple of years ago, there was a presentation from Le Coco at the ASH meeting, plenary session, where in low-risk APL, patients were compared to either ATRA-arsenic or AIDA, which is idarubicin and ATRA, and maintenance therapy. And he showed clearly that ATRA-arsenic is as good, if not better, than chemotherapy-based regimen. And now everybody is more comfortable using non-chemotherapy approach. For this patient with a high risk, we use gentuzumab with ozogamicin at MD Anderson on a compassionate use, the anti-CD33 that was withdrawn from the market. In the community, you may give idarubicin. The reason why? Because she had a high count. I gave her gentuzumab with ozogamicin, drop her count, and maintain on therapy. So she did receive her treatment. Around day 15, 16, she's having a headache. The headache is essentially ATRA-driven, increasing the hypertension in the brain. So we give her Diamox, she improved. And then day 21, I stopped the treatment, did a bone marrow on her. She had no disease left by morphology. I started the treatment, and I'm seeing her tomorrow. She'll be 5 weeks into therapy. She recovered her count, and she's into CR.
Gemtuzumab and APL, is that commonly done?
Well, you know, the APL, they have an expression of CD33. And historically, gentuzumab was, I mean, the old studies done, advantage was observed in patients with good risk features, among them APL A21 and inversion 16. Yes, it is. No, the drug is not commercially available. So for my colleagues in the community, either refer the patient or ask for compassionate use, or use idarubicin instead. If you have somebody with high-risk features, essentially count above 10,000, platelets below 30,000.
That's fascinating. Anything new in terms of, you mentioned, you know, the importance of administering ATRA early on in APL. And my understanding is we still are seeing deaths, early deaths from this disease. Can you talk about what we've learned about what's going on? I was shocked because I've been hearing, you know, this issue for years. Recently, somebody said there are a lot of hospitals that don't have ATRA. They can't get it.
That is true. Well, they cannot get it, I don't know, but that is true.
Well, they can't get it, you know, immediately. It's not on stock.
You know, whenever somebody calls me and tells me, I want to refer to somebody with AML, I will tell them, have you checked our road? You're suspecting APL. Is any evidence of DIC? If they say yes, I will tell them, I will take the patient. Please start them on ATRA immediately, right away. And the reason why I want to block this bleeding issue, because I lose my patient from bleeding early on. And when you look at the trials, you see results are fantastic. Yeah, they are. Because patients who bled, they died before they make it. So the key issue is to start ATRA as soon as possible. Now, 50% of them will tell me, I don't have it available. Then you do what you can. But I think any hospital that can see leukemia should have ATRA like at least for one patient in stock, just in case.
That's fascinating.
And you give her one dose, which is 45 milligrams per square. You give divided. So you give 5 tablets, 10 milligram tablets, and you send them to Anderson or any other place where they deal with leukemia.
Are you still seeing patients who are, you know, not being treated expeditiously, who have bleeds? And do we know nationally how often that happens?
You know, it does happen. I don't know the sense how many cases, but I can tell you myself, I had a patient who died arriving to Houston because the doctor told him, drive and go to MD Anderson. It was on a Thanksgiving holiday, and he had a bleeding when he came to Mercy Center, and he collapsed and died. We couldn't save him. So it's still happening.
How long ago was that?
2 years ago, I was on call on Thanksgiving holiday.
Wow. How old was the patient?
In mid-50s. Curable. I mean, but here we are.
How far away from Houston was he headed?
5 hours driving, and he drove himself.
Wow.
Yeah, it's irresponsible. I mean, not the patient, unfortunately, but whoever sent him.